I don't know how many 94-year-olds you know, but I'm guessing you don't know many quite as sharp as the ex-prisoner of war I caught up with in Idaho. He was shot down on his 27th mission as a top turret gunner on a B-17.
Then I looked out over the wings and I saw all the wings was on fire.
Wait till you hear the rest of that story. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll do just that by joining me for Hometown Heroes today at 1 on News Talk 580. And don't forget, Hometown Heroes also airs now at 5 o'clock on FM 105.9 KMJ.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on News Talk 580 KMJ and now airing every Saturday evening at 5 on FM 105.9 KMJ. You can also find us online at kmjnow.com. Each week we visit with veterans of World War II. The idea really threefold. It's to honor them for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories for posterity, and along the way, the rest of us can learn a thing or two and be inspired for their love for their country. And that name, Hometown Heroes, is there because of my theory that no matter where you go in this great country of ours, no matter where your hometown is, there are some people around you who have done a lot more than you know to preserve our freedom here in America. And we're going to meet one of those gentlemen today. He lives in Lewiston, Idaho. 94-year-old Frank Avery, our guest. You will not believe what this man has been through. And you'll be amazed that he's still going at 94, going strong at that. Frank, I know you gave up golf, but you still drive? What else keeps you busy?
I drive and I dance once in a while and I do other things. I exercise the average of 3 days a week and I keep myself in great shape so I can live to be 100.
100? You're going to settle at 100? I had a guy last week tell me his goal is to be the oldest World War II veteran left.
I think I'll try for that too.
Well, and I guess Rotary keeps you kind of busy, too. You travel quite a ways to be a Rotarian.
I travel all the way to Orofina. It's about a 65-mile round trip, and I love the club, and I've been a Rotarian since 1954, and I really enjoy it.
Well, and you never would have been a Rotarian if not for a few things that you survived that people are going to be amazed that you survived. But before that, I want to go back. You grew up in a coal mining country in Pennsylvania. When did you decide that a military career was going to be a good idea for you?
Well, I really didn't decide. Uncle Sam decided for me. I tried to enlist back right before the war, and they turned me down because I already had a conscript number, so I had to go back home. Then they enlisted me into the Army Air Force.
And so you were actually in the Army when Pearl Harbor happened. You're at Jefferson Barracks, Missouri. How'd you hear about this? What was it like to get that news there on a military installation?
Well, we were sitting, you know, we always listened to news because, you know, there was no television or anything like that. But we were sitting there about 09 something in the morning. That's when it happened in Pearl. So maybe it was 11 o'clock, something like that, when we heard an announcer call and said that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. Well, a whole bunch of people said to me, where in the world is Pearl Harbor? Well, I knew because I'd studied history when I was a young man in school. And I said, why, that's in Hawaiian Islands. And that's when it all started.
And most people that I talk to, I ask every single veteran I've interviewed, hundreds of people, I've asked this question, where were you when you heard about the attacks? Most of them have a civilian memory. To be at a military base and find out, uh-oh, now we're at war. Was there some scrambling going on? Did it turn pretty chaotic, or was it calm and peaceful?
No, it was calm and peaceful. You know, when you're in the military, you do what you're told, and you just follow orders and conduct yourself like you need to be conducted.
Did it give you the idea that maybe things were about to accelerate for you in terms of getting in something a little more serious?
Well, that's a long story. You know, I went on to AM school, which was aircraft mechanics school. And then from there, I volunteered to go to gunnery school in Las Vegas, Nevada, which I did. And then I moved to Kingman, Arizona. And I decided then that I would like to go to combat. So I volunteered for combat. And that was the baddest thing I ever did. I was a bad move. And I went to, I was a B-17 top turret engineer. And we flew all over the country training. And went to Europe and flew 27 missions on a B-17. Got shut down on the May the 28th, 1944. And spent about 11 months with the Germans eating good sauerkraut, don't believe that. And it was something, and it was quite an experience, but I enjoyed it. Not enjoyed it, but it was something to do. I met some wonderful, wonderful people.
Well, I'm going to ask you a lot of questions about that, and I see the nice photo of a B-17 on your wall here representing the 351st Bomb Group. You just gave us the nutshell version and an overview, but let's talk specifics. So you end up a top turret gunner and engineer on a B-17 crew. You talk about meeting some great people. How did you bond with the guys on your crew, and were you able to keep that crew together?
We were real close. So from the time that we formed in Pyote, Texas, all the way through until we got shut down, we were a close-knit group. Before we went overseas, the crew and the pilot, the officers, we always went out to dinner together. It wasn't, you're enlisted and I'm an officer, we don't get together. But this crew, we were just great. And all the way through until, well, we lost a few of the people. We lost one to measles, and we lost another one to other things. Once we started flying combat, it was a good, you know, when you're flying combat, you've got to have your eyes open, you got to keep your ears open, because you never know when you're going to get in trouble, which I did.
I get the sense, just when I shook your hand and saw the look in your eye, that you've gotten in a lot of trouble in your life, and you enjoy it a little bit. But we're going to hear some of those stories. You talk about getting into combat. As you prepared for that, now, you're about 4 years older than some of those guys on your crew. Do you think that made you a little more prepared for combat, or what was your mindset going into your first mission? Do you remember that first mission?
Well, the first mission was rather unique. The charge of quarters who comes in and wakes you up and says, get dressed, breakfast at so-and-so, briefing at so-and-so. Well, this one gentleman woke me up about 3 o'clock in the morning and said, breakfast at so-and-so, you're going on a mission. I said, how about the rest of my crew? He says, oh, no. He said, you're spare. You've got to go and fly on another airplane. So I was the first person to fly a combat mission in my crew. So we took off. We went down to the southern Germany. Had a pretty good time. A few fighters. And on the way back, I made the mistake of pulling a chain on my May West, and it inflated, and I couldn't get out of the turret. So I had to call the co-pilot. I said, hey, come on down and help me out. So he did. And, of course, I was the first one to fly the mission. When I got home, the whole crew was there to meet me. They said, how was it? I said, not worth a hoot.
Well, sounds like a hoot to me, and I was right about you getting into trouble. And I'm sure I've seen that in a movie somewhere, the guy who pulls the cord and something inflates around him and he's stuck. So it sounds like you were the inspiration of that. When that May West was not inflated, how tight of a situation was that top turret? And what was the view like from up there?
Well, top turret, you know, I had a 360-degree view of everything. I could go from level 9 o'clock or 12 o'clock all the way around. The only place I couldn't fire was at the tail. There was a cutoff switch. There had to be a cutoff switch, because if it wasn't, you'd shoot your tail off. And I went by there a lot of times with the gun blazing. But I had a lot of one mission I was on. A piece of flak come through the plexiglass and hit me right on the head. This, I guess that was my 10th or 15th mission, and it knocked me out. Where I goofed up at, I should have reported to the doctors, and I would have got the Purple Heart, which I didn't do.
Well, yeah. Now, that sounds intriguing to me, and I've talked to a lot of different guys on bomber crews. A lot of people don't realize how cold it could be on those B-17s on some of those missions, and also that sometimes you guys had choices in terms of what you could wear. You could wear a heated suit if you want. You could wear a flak suit.
Well, there was no room for flak suit. Later on, they came up with helmets, you know. Well, mine was just a leather helmet, and we wore the heated suits, which, because at times, I can remember the temperature being anywhere from 80 to 85 to 90 below zero, and that's awful cold. I can remember a couple of times when the breath from your oxygen apparatus would form an icicle under, and it'd get about a foot and a half long, and then I'd hit it and it'd go tinkling down the floor. And one other time, we were flying, and I was looking out about 9 o'clock over the left wing, and I noticed a big hole appear in the wing. It just peeled, you know, like it would peel an orange. And guess what came up? A great big shell came right through that wing, made a great big turn, and then fell back to earth. Am I glad that was a dud?
You wouldn't be here talking to me if it wasn't a dud.
No, I sure wouldn't be.
So I want to hear about this mission where the flak hits you in the head. So you're up in that turret, and was it a regular occurrence on your bombing missions to see opposing fighters in the sky, or was most of the time the anti-aircraft from the ground what you guys had to worry about?
The anti-aircraft was tough, but I was more afraid of anti-aircraft fire than I was of fighters. I would say that on the 27 missions that I flew, we had flak every mission, even if it was over France, if it was a no-ball target, which was, you know, close by. But I would say that 95% of my missions, we experienced fighters and had some pretty good fights.
So what did that feel like for you if you're in that turret? Because I imagine from the moment you take off, you're on alert and you're looking for fighters and you're getting ready. And when they don't come, it probably just builds the anticipation. And then when they actually show up, it seems to me that you would get a bit of an adrenaline rush or feel a little different. What did it feel like for you when you saw a fighter in the sky and you knew you were going to have a shot to try to take him out?
Well, that's true. Like, for example, the day I got shot down, for some reason, we got turned around and had to make a complete 360-degree turn to get back into formation. And I counted over 100 to 120 fighters, and the record says it was 90. But can you imagine being hit by 120 fighters? And they were coming in on us 8, 10, 15 at a time. And, of course, we didn't last long. And it lit up. All our tanks were lit up on the wings. The ball turret operator was killed. And we were all wounded, but most of us bailed out. My pilot got killed. He was afraid to bail out. He bailed out when he was about 2,000 feet, and they found him right close to the airplane. But it was dandy. On my second mission, a crew that I had been with all the way from Pyote, Texas, I watched them get shot down. Fighters come out of the sky about right out of the sun. They had a habit of doing that. They'd hide in the sun and come in at you, and it'd be a while before you could catch them. They were shooting before you knew it. And I watched this crew go down. They were great friends of mine, and I watched the whole airplane go down, and I watched it hit the ground. Terrible, terrible situation.
So that was your second mission, and you see that happen. Does that tell you, I mean, you're grieving for them, but isn't there part of you that says that could happen to me?
Well, every time we took off from Peterborough, England at Pulbrook, that was it. Are we coming home? That was the thought. Are we going to make it home?
What did you do? Was there anything you felt you could do to make sure that you came home? Did you have any superstitions, any routines, any habits? Did you pray? I've talked to a lot of guys who've said that. What was it like for you, just mentally and emotionally, to get up and hope that you were coming down?
You know, I was prepared. I'm a strong-willed person. I have good morals, and I thought, and really, I knew that whatever would happen, that the chances are that I would survive. But I know a lot of them didn't. But it was just one of those situations. And when you're in combat, you don't get scared; you react, and you have to react to protect yourself, and that's what you do.
So on the mission where you were actually hit in the head, did you see something coming? Did you know that you were about to get hit, or did you just get knocked out?
No, that was just a burst of flak above us, and one of them big pieces came right down, and and that was it. And I didn't know what in the world happened. I woke up maybe 10 seconds later, and I thought, oh, Lord. And I reached up, and there was a piece of metal that hit me. It was about 2 inches in diameter. And matter of fact, I kept it all the way through prison camp, and I don't know what happened to it. I lost it.
So did you feel, I mean, and you had only a leather helmet on. How close do you think that piece of flak came to killing you?
Well, if the shell had been a little closer, it would have probably got me. But it was just one of those incidents, you know, where it wasn't your time.
And when we talked about what you were thinking going on these missions, but when you came home from that mission and you held on to that piece of flak, did it feel a little differently than some of those other missions? Did you feel like you had dodged something more serious or were even more fortunate to be around?
Yeah, I think so. Really, I didn't think that much about it. You know, I never tell the truth. I never, when I got back and the doctors asked you anything wrong, I didn't tell them anything. And I guess I should have, like I told you before, if I would have, I would have got the, I would have got the Purple Heart sooner. And I'll tell you about when the month I'd really got the Purple Heart.
Well, that sounds like a good tease, and it's perfectly timed because it's time for our first commercial break. But we have lots more to explore with Frank Avery. He mentioned the word survivor, and that defines him like you wouldn't believe. We're going to hear some of the things he's survived during World War II, during his captivity at the hands of the Germans, and even after World War II. You'll find it hard to believe, but it's all true, and we'll get the story next as Hometown Heroes continues on KMJ.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis, its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. My guest today, 94-year-old Frank Avery of Lewiston, Idaho. He grew up in Pennsylvania originally. During World War II, he was flying with the 351st Bomb Group. So 27 missions with the 351st Bomb Group. We talked about your second mission when you saw your friends shot down and killed and how you dealt with that. A mission where flak comes through the plexiglass in that top turret and knocks you out cold, but you survive. As you keep flying these missions, were you emboldened? Did you feel like the chances were better you were going to survive and make it home? Or did you kind of feel like the more missions you flew, the better the chances that you weren't going to land that day?
Well, to tell the truth, you really didn't think about that much. You had a job to do, and we never really thought about, well, are we really going to get it today? And when it happens, all of a sudden it's done. But let me tell you a little story. After I bailed out in World War II off that 27th bomb mission, I landed in a forest. And, of course, I hid out a little bit, and I climbed up into a deer tower that they have in Germany. It's up about 15, 20 feet off the ground. Well, I crawled up there, and I just looked around for a while and figured, what in the world am I going to do? Well, and a little later, I climbed down, and I start walking. And I noticed that my right shoe, every time I'd step on it, it'd squish. And I thought, well, there's something wrong. So I dropped my trousers, and right inside of my right leg, up near my groin, was a great big piece of metal. It was embedded probably about 2.5 inches in, and about 2 inches of it sticking out. Well, I said, that's what the problem is. My shoe was full of blood. My leg was all bloody. Well, we carried what they call escape kits with us, which had bandages, sulfur drug, morphine tablets, escape maps, so in case you wanted to escape if you were dumb enough to try to get out of Germany. But anyway, I pulled that thing out, and matter of fact, I kept it for a long time, and then I opened my kit and took out the bandages, put sulfur drug on the wound, bandaged it up, and after that, it healed. So, and I didn't get I got the Purple Heart for that after I got back and worked from World War II.
Well, you're starting quite the flak collection there. I want to go back before you had to bail out. That mission itself, what was your target that day? Did you have any indication ahead of time that you were going to face the fierce fighter opposition that ended up greeting you in the sky?
No, really we didn't, because at that time the P-51s and the P-47s pretty well had control of the German skies. But if just this one day the German Air Force decided to put up a max effort, and we just happened to be in their way. Now, it was our group was the only ones that got hit. Nobody else got touched, and we lost, I think, 5 airplanes altogether in our group.
And you were trying to bomb a factory in Germany that day?
We were after an oil refinery in Dessau, Germany, on the way out in the eastern part of the country.
So you're up there, and you described it earlier. You counted over 100 opposition fighters. So when you're a top turret gunner and there are fighters everywhere you look, what do you do? I mean, how do you respond in that situation? Do you fire blindly? Do you have time to focus on one guy and try to take him out? Do you get your parachute ready and make sure you're ready to bail out? I mean, how did you respond?
Well, you know, they didn't hit you with 100 or not. You know, 3 or 4 had come in at a time, you know, and they were hitting all areas of our group. So you just try to, the winner was the closest, you locked in on him and fired. I know that in my all the time that I flew the 27 missions, that I know that I was involved in shooting at least 5 or 6 German fighters down. I got a lot of probables, but I never got confirmed.
Well, there has to be someone there to confirm it, and a lot of time you don't have time to sit around and watch a plane go down when people are shooting at you. So when did that decision to bail out of your B-17 come, and what did that feel like? Because I'm sure you've gone through in your mind the possibility of this happening, the possibility that your plane's going to be disabled and you're going to have to bail out. When did you realize that that time had actually come?
Just as we got hit by the fighters, my oxygen tanks exploded, and I can remember the white flame just enveloping me from the oxygen tanks. In other words, no more oxygen. Then I looked out over the wings, and I saw all the wings was on fire. We had 2 engines shot out. I called up the pilot and the co-pilot. I said, we're in bad shape. Let's get out of here. And about that time, they rang the bailout bell. And my parachute was at the chest pack and was hooked up behind the pilot. So when I got out of the top turret, I had to take that chest pack and clip it on my parachute. And I was the first one, I think I was the first one out of the airplane. As I was going down the hatch to go out the front escape hatch, the navigator said, don't go, don't go. I said, get out of my way. And out I went. And I probably delayed my pulling my parachute for about 20 seconds. That's what you was told to do. Wait till you get down to lower altitude so you don't pass out for the lack of oxygen. And I landed in that forest.
And you didn't even realize that you had a 4.5-inch long piece of metal in your leg. You hadn't even felt it in the chaos. So you're on the ground, and you talked about that, and you treat yourself. And then I'm sure all kinds of things start to go through your mind. Are the Germans going to find me? Where do I go? How do I get out of here? Pick up the story from there for us if you can.
I walked around a little bit in the forest, and all of a sudden I heard a shout, and lo and behold, there were 2 Germans with guns, and I became a prisoner. And I ended up in a German airfield, and my whole crew was there when I got there, except my pilot and my ball turret operator who got killed. And from then on, it was quite a journey.
Well, I want to hear about that journey, and was it comforting to see your crew there? And did you feel like that made it a little easier for you to deal with the uncertainty, the fear that could creep in, not knowing if you'll ever be free again? Or you don't know who's going to win the war. I mean, you don't have history at your side. So did it help to have those other guys with you?
Oh, yes, that was the most comfortable thing. When I walked in that, when they took me in that room, the big room, and I saw my crew, man, I was relieved, because I knew that I had people that would be with me and help me, and we could help each other. And of course, that's what we all did as a crew, you know.
And so I'm sure they had deluxe accommodations waiting for you, rolled out the red carpet and drove you in a limo to wherever they're going to take you. What was it really like to be a prisoner of the Germans and not know what they were doing with you? And how did that unfold to where you actually ended up in the prisoner of war camp?
From that airfield, they took us in an old German bus. Now, this is a good story. It was a charcoal, run by charcoal, you know, and there was about 35 of us in this bus, and on the level ground, it moved pretty good. When it come to a hill, everybody had to go out, push the bus up to the top of the hill, then down the hill we'd go again. And we ended up in Frankfurt, Germany, at the Estella Gluft interrogation camp. We was there about a week. That's when they threatened to kill you, threatened to shoot you. They want to know everything. And I found out that they knew more about me than I wanted to tell them. But, you know, they had quite a system. And then then we went by train to Stella Gluft 4 up in northern Poland. And that's where I spent all that time until about February of 1945 when we moved out of there and went down to Nuremberg. Let me tell you a little story that happened to me in the camp. We were Christmas Eve. The Germans allowed us to stay out until 11:30 at night. Before that, at 6 o'clock, in you went, and they would bolt the doors, and you didn't get out until next morning. Then every morning, it was a roll call. Snow, it made a difference. Anyway, they allowed us to stay out until about 11:30. Well, there were four compounds, over 12,000 people in these compounds, and at 11:30, when the Germans flashed the light, everybody in that all four compounds start singing Silent Night. Well, you have never heard a choir in your life like that. Then after we were done, as we were marching back to our barracks, the Germans and a few female voices sang Silent Night in their German language. And I want to tell you, it was beautiful.
Is it Stille Nacht? Is that how they say it? Uh-huh. And I could see how that would stick to you and change your outlook. But I know I keep coming back and going backwards on you to ask you questions. But a week at Dulag Luft, the infamous interrogation center, and you said they knew more about you than you know about yourself. But how did they treat you? Were they threatening? I've heard some guys were roughed up a little bit. What was it like for you in that interrogation? And how was their English, the guys that were talking to you?
Well, the man that interrogated me would be equivalent of a master sergeant in the United States Army, and he was sharp. His English was perfect. And I asked him one time, where did you learn? He said, well, I spent a little time in your country. And he told me that I was married. He told me when I went to England, when I went into service. And he told me all a bunch of things. Of course, the only thing that I told him, I gave him my name, rank, and serial number. And that was it. And they threatened me to they were going to really rough me up, and I might hit the firing squad. But if that happened, that's what happened.
And you mentioned they transported you by train up to Poland. Now, when people think of a train, they might think of the Amtrak or a passenger train they know now. But I'm guessing you were on a 40-8, right?
We were in a 40-8. They were boxcars, and we were locked in. And we got, one time, our engine got strafed and knocked out, and they finally put another one on. But I was able to etch a little opening in the side of the car, so I was able to see a lot of things going on. So I got to see a lot of Germany from that peephole. But finally, we ended up at Kiefheide, which was the name of the little town. Then they marched us about 2.5 miles to the camp, and they marched in the camp, and you had to go in single file till they interrogated you. And they had a little story about a guy named Big Stoop. He was a biggest German ever seen in my life. He must have been 7'2" if he was an inch. He was a mean rascal. And why he took on me, I'll never know. But when I walked up to the desk and walked away a little bit, he kicked me on the rump, and he kicked me all the way to the wall. I was sore for at least 2 weeks after that. But I found out later, after the liberation of the Americans in Munich, that the British caught a hold of him, cut his head off, and struck on the pole at the gate.
Wow. That, I haven't heard one quite like that before. And, you know, you gave us the highlight of your time in Stalag Luft 4 in terms of the silent night and the Germans echoing back and all of that, and what a great human moment that was. But in general, your time at the camp, and you were shot down in May of 44. You end up in that camp shortly thereafter. What did you have to eat? How did you stay warm? What kept you believing that you could survive this? Because, again, there's got to be a whole lot of uncertainty in your mind.
When you come to warmth, you know, we were pretty close to the Baltic Sea, probably about 15 miles away. And, you know, there was a warm, I don't think I can ever remember getting down to zero. A lot of snow. And we did have a little few of what they call briquettes to keep. We had a little stove in our room and little briquettes, and we'd save them till it got really cold. And we all slept with our clothes on. Never, we didn't have any pajamas. You slept with your clothes, and about every week you'd wash them in cold water. But it was, you know, every day we'd done the same thing. You visited, you'd done this. I'd visit with a Catholic chaplain, and I'd visit with all the chaplains to make sure how they're doing all right and I was doing all right. But it was a long, long process. You know, you never know. One time in May, it was in the latter part of July, in August. See, I was married, and my wife was pregnant, and she was due to have a child in July. Well, I didn't know anything about that until 2 months later. One sergeant named Airy, who ended up the chief master sergeant of the Air Force, first one, he came in to me, and he said, "You're Frank Avery?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Here, I have a telegram for you." He said, your son has been born, and it's not mine because I wasn't married." So it went to him first, and then he gave it to me, and that's when I found out that my son Frank Clyde was born.
I can't imagine what that must have been like for you and what went through your mind, not knowing if you would ever get to even meet your son. How did you process all of that?
Well, all those things are in your mind, you know, and I kept, of course, the thing is, I would get letters, what they call the postcards from Ruth, and she kept me informed what was going on. And of course, the postcards we got through the Geneva Convention, some of them were 2-3 months old, you know, and it was good. And finally, I was so happy to hear that I was a proud daddy.
I can't imagine what that must have been like. And I also, all the POWs I've interviewed, I can never really have the stomach for hearing what they actually had to eat. I'm guessing at Stalag Luft 4, they didn't serve up plate-sized burgers like they do at Effie's here in Lewiston.
Well, tell you a little story about the bean. The bean had a little dark spot in it. One day I thought to myself, let me see what that dark spot looks like. I squeezed it, and I popped a little worm. Well, you know what I said? Worm, watch out for yourself. I ate it all. And I would say that four times a week we would get that. But, you know, it was boiled. It was good protein. No problem. We had a lot of potatoes. But what really was bad, folks know what a kohlrabi is. That's a big cow turnip. Well, we were fed that. And that was the most awful food I've ever eaten in my life. And but you had to eat some of it, but most of it got thrown away. But the Red Cross parcel is what saved us. We were supposed to get one Red Cross parcel a week, I should say, but we were lucky to get a half of one a month. And of course, it had a lot of D-bars and all different kind of good stuff in it, and that did help us. But if one person got sick or something, then we would help him out to, you know, share our food with that person. It depends just what the situation was.
Well, and the one thing I didn't hear you mention there was the bread. I've heard that bread you could use for a paperweight or maybe mount up your truck on it like a jack. I mean, that bread seems like it was quite the hard one to chew and digest.
Well, it's the hardest stuff for everyone to eat. But we used to chop it all up, and we'd get D-bars and all that in our Red Cross parcels. We'd cook up the doggondest food you ever seen. And one thing about being a prisoner of war, you always dream about food. Now, let me say this. I was hungry for almost a whole year, except two times. Christmas time, we had a full parcel, and when we went on the train to Nuremberg, I had a full parcel. That's the only two times I ever had what you call a full stomach. But, you know, when you're in a situation like that, your survival takes over. And that's just the way it is. Let's get back to when we went to Nuremberg. In April of 1945, the American army was coming through, and so Hitler decided to move all of the prisoners there to Munich, it was a big camp there. So this one morning, they lured us 3 or 4 days ahead of time. So this morning, we all line up and start down the road. And I understand there's probably 30,000. Now, they're not only Americans. They're British. They're Poles. They're Russians. All of them. And the first day out, about 10:30 in the morning, the P-47s were above us, and all of a sudden, they came down and strafed us. They strafed the column. They thought that we were a German army movement, you know. Well, we was able to make signs with clothes and all POW. And after that, they stayed above us. One was up all the time that day. There was a P-47 up above us watching us. Well, when them fighters came down and hit and strafed, them bullets went right by me. I'll bet they didn't miss me 5 feet. Me and my radio operator decided then if we had a chance, we was going to get out of that march. Well, we spent a night in Poland, Germany, and then next day we started out again, and we come to a turn in the road. No guards in front, no guards in the back. Well, me and my radio operator, we jump in the woods and land on top of a lieutenant that had blisters so big they covered his feet. Well, we ended up with him, and I ended up spending time in the mountains, in the hills, walking around Germany, and finally got picked up, put in jail, got turned loose again, spent time in the mayor's house, and then he took us out and turned us loose, and he said, go that way, that's where your comrades are, and we ended up in a little town called Poland, Germany, the exact town that we spent the first night in. And I had a German farmer hide me out. And he put me up in a barn that evening. And he said, the Americans are close by. Well, next morning I get up about 5 o'clock in the morning, and I walk out through a side door, and I walk right out in the middle of the German army. I said, oh, Lord, you know, not a one of them people noticed me. I walk back in the house, shut the barn door, and climbed up in the hay mile, up in the hay area, and I told the lieutenant, I said, the whole German army's out there. Well, about that time, the shooting started, and we spent all day down in a silo, dug into the ground of the barn, and about 5 o'clock in the evening, heard a voice say, anybody in here? Well, we hollered, yeah, we're in here. Well, they pulled the 2 or 3 soldiers and a big captain from Texas, pulled the boards away, and what they said to me was, come up with your hands in the air. Well, can you imagine climbing a ladder with your hands in the air? You can't do it. Well, we got to the top, and boy, he greeted us, and after that, I ended up Camp Lucky Strike, got on the ship, and come home and saw my boy.
Well, it's a lot to talk about, and I want to ask you some more questions about that. We need to catch our final commercial break. When we come back, we'll hear more of Frank Avery's story. What a story it is. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 150, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The pasta possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common: Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. My guest today is 94-year-old Frank Avry. That is the correct French pronunciation of his last name, A-V-R-Y, Avry. And we've been talking about all of his adventures during World War II. When we left off, he had talked about being liberated and getting off that march with a bunch of other prisoners. Now, at the time, I'm sure you were just trying to survive, but the benefit of history tells you that a lot of other guys were not so fortunate. What have you learned since the war? And people on this program have heard about it before, but what have you learned about what happened to the other soldiers who were in Stalag Luft 4 and were marched out of there, and how far they went and what it meant?
Well, most of the people that were on the train that were going down the Nuremberg, that they all of them, most of them made it out. But the real bad part was a great number of the prisoners that were in Stalag Luft 4 went out on a march. And they marched for over 3 months all over Germany. And this was in the middle of winter. And a lot of them died. And it was almost as bad as what the death march was in Japan and in the Philippines. But there's a great story about that. Dr. Kaplan, who was our doctor, the one that took care of me, he was considered really the hero that saved so many of them young men. Kept them going, carried them. Done a great job. He should have been awarded the Medal of Honor.
And I know if you sat around doing this, you wouldn't think about anything else because there have been so many times in your story already where it could have been you and it could have been the end for you. When you heard about that, what's been called the German Black Death March from Poland across Europe, when you heard about that, what did that mean to you? Did you feel like, wow, that could have been me and I could have died?
I really didn't know about it until later on when I got to talking to some of them that had been on it. And matter of fact, when a boy from Indianapolis who I was in contact with was on the march, and then he kept me informed of what was going on, and he also sent me the book that was written about the death march, which is absolutely terrible. And I said to myself, Frank, that could have been you. If I would have been two barracks down from where I was, it would have been me. I'd have been on that march. And whether I'd have made it or not, I don't know.
Well, I'm glad you did. And I can say that about 50 times with your story, with all the twists and turns it's taken. But you mentioned right before we took that break, getting home and seeing your son. Now, your wife was pregnant. You're overseas. You're a prisoner of war. You get the telegram finding out that you have a son. To meet him for the first time, and to look at this kid that you've never seen before, you have no idea. What was that like for you?
It was a little town in Golconda, Illinois, down in southern Illinois on the Ohio River is where my wife was. That's where she was born, where she was staying while I was in service. And I had it from Harrisburg, Illinois, down to Golconda, which is the town of about 3,000 or 4,000 right on the river. I had to take a taxi from Harrisburg down, and the taxi took me right in front of the house and dropped me off. And as I got out of the taxi, there was my wife, Ruth, holding my son, Frank, about maybe 20 yards from me. Well, I just made a beeline run and hugged them both. It was great.
That I can just imagine. And anyone who's a parent can imagine what must have gone through your mind. But it strikes me, did he know who you were? Had he been shown pictures of you? Did he have any idea? Could you tell in his eyes that he knew you were his daddy?
He was only about 9, 10 months old, so you know, he probably looked at me and said, "Who are you?"
Well, I'm pretty sure he knows now. So you're free again. What did that mean to you in the grand scheme of things? To have been not free, to have been a prisoner. I'm sure you lost a ton of weight in captivity. To not know what was going to happen to you, and then finally to have an idea and to be back on free terrain in America. What did that mean to you, and did you have a concept of how significant that was?
Yeah, it was a relief, you know. When I did get liberated, I weighed 111 pounds, so you can imagine I lost a lot of weight. My normal weight then was around 145. But it didn't take me too long to put it back on. I was real careful what I ate because, you know, you don't want to overeat and get in trouble. And when I was in Camp Lucky Strike before I took the ship back to the States, they were real cautious with us. We were given 5 meals a day. The first meal was at 6 o'clock in the morning. Now, that was a small amount. Then about 10 o'clock, we got a little more. Then at noon, we got a little more. So through the day, we had five small meals, and we had doctors watching us close. When I got liberated, tell you a little story. When I got liberated by the American Army, and they took me down to a house and set me up, and the first thing I said to them, I said, "What do you have to eat?" They said, "What do you want?" I said, "Do you have any spaghetti?" They said, "Yes." They gave me a can of spaghetti. I opened it up, took a fork, and I ate every bit of that. Well, it wasn't only a couple of minutes, and I'm outside getting rid of it. Well, old dumb me, you know, I think no problem, so I got another can. I ate half of it and done the same thing, and I said to myself, "Whoa, whoa, whoa." I'll tell you a little another story about something to eat. Before we met this German that hit us up in a barn, I contacted a lady in a house, and she said no, she couldn't help us. This when I was still, you know, running free. And she said, asked me, would I like to have some Essen, that's food. And I, yeah. Well, she brought me out a piece of pickled pork. Now, it still had the hair on it. But I want to tell you folks, that is the best piece of meat I've ever eaten in my life, because it was salty, and I chewed. It took me an hour and a half to eat it all, but I ate every bit of it.
Yeah, a little perspective goes a long way in that situation. You said there's a story about you finally getting the Purple Heart, and you didn't put in for it the first time when you were hit in the turret. When you bailed out and came down and found that other piece of shrapnel in your leg, you finally did get the Purple Heart for that. How did that come about, and did that mean anything to you?
Oh, not really. I was a civilian, and I was living in Youngstown, Ohio. That's where I was. That's where I was brought up as a young man, and was a investigator from the war's crime came to see me and wanted to know if anything had happened to me and all that. And I told him a few. You know, I really never was mistreated, only by that German stoop that kicked me. But I mentioned to him, I said, you know, I had a big wound in my leg. And he said, oh. And he made notes of that. And, you know, about a week and a half later, 2 weeks later, I get a box. In there is a Purple Heart, and it's got my name on it. And so that's how I ended up getting the Purple Heart. By the way, I do have the Air Medal and the clusters, and I have a Prisoner of War Medal and things like that. These young men have been looking at it.
Yep, and I'll take a picture of that and make sure we put it on our website, kmjnow.com. You can also see what Frank looked like as a young man, what he looks like now at 94 years young. But that's not the end of your story. Your story goes a lot deeper than that. First of all, I want to know, if you're shot down, you end up as a POW, you feel in so many ways fortunate to be alive, why do you stay in the Air Force for 30 years?
Well, I got out for a while, and, you know, at that time work wasn't too, and I didn't like what was going on. So I asked, I told my wife, you know, I'm going to go back in. Well, I was a tech sergeant, making fairly good money. So I reenlisted, and I got back, and I did spend 30 years in the Air Force, and I retired as a chief master sergeant in the United States Air Force. Now, we may go to another story if this gentleman wants me to tell it.
Of course I do, but we're out of time for today. So tune in next week to hear Frank Avery. His wife Esther has helped him rediscover that authentic French pronunciation of his last name. But Frank was the sole survivor of a military plane crash in Montana's aptly named Crazy Mountains in 1946. And we'll get that incredible story from 94-year-old Frank Avery of Lewiston, Idaho next Saturday. Go to kmjnow.com to learn more, and thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes on KMJ.